Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And this week, is it the end of free banking? Murmurs from HSBC HQ suggest an overhaul of its business model could leave customers forking out for their current accounts. Meanwhile, who's winning the battle? The switchers. Talking of ends, the furlough scheme closes this weekend to be replaced by the less generous job support scheme, but it's not the only financial support that's changing, including free overdrafts, payment holidays, and a halt on repossessions. How can you stop this Halloween from being a nightmare? We'll also revisit the impact that fear of a second wave in the upcoming US elections is having on the stock market. Plus, we talk bitcoins and boilers. Not together, though. To my mind, the two aren't related. I'm sure we could find a way to relate them, but not this time. Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, Lee's been singing to himself this week. And Lee, what have you been singing?
Oh, Georgie, don't make me do it in a Michael Stipe voice of REM, but I've been singing It's the End of Free Banking as We Know It, potentially. Oh,
give us a little ditty. No?
No.
No? Oh, fine. And why have you been singing that, Lee?
Well, Georgie, this week we have had a number of British banks and international banks giving out some of their quarterly reports. So it's a kind of snapshot of how they're performing and what's going on. And actually, on the whole, big banks, Lloyds, Santander, Barclays and HSBC have all actually had a kind of solid enough quarter given all of the coronavirus madness that's been going on. And actually, a couple of them have even reported sort of above forecast profits. Now, HSBC, which had a £2 billion profit, quarterly profit, has seen that profit collapse sort of 35-odd% annually. So they're seeing profit margins being squeezed. Now, what some of these banks said in their quarterly reports is the threat of negative interest rates, which has been a kind of economic topic of the last couple of months, the murmurs of potentially the Bank of England putting negative interest rates out there for the first time ever, could be a potential profit buster for them. And let's face it, banks are businesses. You know, they want to make profits. That's what they want to do. As a customer, you know, they want to make money from you. That's what they want to do. Now, current accounts notoriously can be quite expensive products for people to have. And if you don't use your overdraft, for example, you know, that's where banks make a lot of their money back. And secondly, they want to cross-sell you other products, right? So you become a current account customer, you might then take out a mortgage, you might take out a personal loan, a credit card, insurance, investing services, all those kind of things. But in the last decade or so, I think customers have wised up a lot and are more likely to switch banks, you know, especially with something like the current account switching service. So we have a lot of choice in this country when it comes to banking. And if you're unhappy about something that your bank does, you can switch quite easily. All your direct debits get moved over and it should be a nice smooth process. It's definitely becoming easier in recent years. And we've had this conversation before. A lot of people open a bank account perhaps when they leave school or start university, and probably they pick one that just at that time you might have had a branch in your town, or it might have had some sort of like silly offer for you to sign up. And people stay loyal to those banks for a very, very long time, just because actually on the whole, you know, the majority of the time banks treat us pretty well. You know, if you're a current account customer and you play by the rules, it does what it says in the tin. It keeps your money safe, and you know, you can take money out of a hole in a wall. You know, some of them have good apps and online banking and all that kind of thing now. But HSBC, what they said in this report is that looming negative interest potential could mean that we could see the end of free banking when it comes to HSBC, aka it might start charging a monthly fee to have a current account, because you know, profits are being squeezed elsewhere. Now, I'm going to point out here that this is a big kind of, it's like almost like a warning shot more than a kind of, we're going to do this.
Yeah.
Right? We've heard these murmurs before. It's nothing new. We've heard of a kind of current accounts might start having a monthly fee type thing. I find it...
Warning to who? To customers to say this could happen, or a warning to governments to say do something else?
I think probably a bit of both. And actually, it's a kind of one of those sort of like warning shots that you can put out there that other banks might see it, for example. So if HSBC started charging for a current account, you can bet your bottom dollar the other big banking boys would probably follow suit, and they wouldn't look as bad as HSBC because they went first type thing. And also, I think it's a reminder to customers that a current account it does cost the bank money if you're not doing other things with it. And we've seen this in the past. I'm going to take Monzo here as an example. So we had these current account switching stats come out this week at the same time. And the two big winners between April and June, you know, that bit of lockdown where we were kind of gets to June and things were sort of softening up a bit and people starting to switch current accounts again. They were number one and two. Monzo and Starling were number one and two for people to actually switch their current account from one bank to another, right? And that's important data for them, because what's happening is a lot of these challenger banks are getting people signing up, but they're not using them as their main current account, right? They're using them as a kind of secondary current account. Money, a couple hundred quid floats around in there, nothing gets done on the account, and it costs them money, right? So if you're actually switching main bank from bank A to Monzo or Starling, that's a more valuable customer to them, right? But Monzo's losing money. It's expensive to attract new customers, to have a glossy app, to have all these things in place to get people into the doors, then they don't have as many products to cross-sell to people. It's difficult if you just offer a current account and maybe one or two other products, not having a whole range of other products that you can then make money from, right? So it becomes an expensive endeavor. And we've seen that it's expensive just to have a current account and not other banking products. I think that HSBC is almost saying to people, don't take us for granted almost. We hold your money. We'll hold your money safely. There might be a price to pay for this coming up soon. But as I say, Georgie, this is something that's been spoken about in the past. And there's this whole argument about, is free banking really free banking?
That's it. It's not really free anyway. And actually what it used to hit was those people that could afford it least the hardest. So those people that went into unauthorized overdrafts.
That's what I mean. I would technically call it free if in credit banking. Really, because if you are in credit, you don't really have any charges or fees attached to that current account. You know, as you say, if you drop into overdraft, that's when you start getting charged. It's almost like that counterbalance. You have the people who are constantly in credit and run their account and don't have to go into the overdraft. Then you have the people that do drop into that overdraft. And we've had a whole raft of overdraft changes this year, which saw some banks put them up to 40%. Which caused a lot of angst and anger among customers. But as I said to you, and as I said at the start of this podcast, you know, banks are businesses, Georgie. They're not here for out of the goodness of their own heart. They're here to make money. You know, and that's the bottom line. They're here to make profits. And if those profit margins are being squeezed, it's not good. And actually, I spoke to Mark Mullen, who's the chief executive of Atom Bank, and he's ex-HSBC, and he was the chief executive of First Direct. And he was saying that actually, this free and credit banking was first introduced by Midland Bank, which of course is now HSBC, back in the mid-80s. And we actually take it for granted. People just take it for granted because, you know, in other countries, you might have to pay a monthly fee to have that current account. In some other countries, you can't just put your card into a hole in the wall and get money out for free unless it's your own bank's cash machine. But the thing is, you know, they make money from doing other bits and pieces that, you know, is all being squeezed. And the thing, I think the thing that didn't make me laugh, that made me kind of go, I'm not sure how likely this is. Well, it's actually two things. Firstly, HSBC has brought out a bribe again to attract customers back in through the doors. So if you switch current accounts with it, it will give you 125 quid. I mean, that's £125 to switch bank account. You know, that is like £10 a month, right? I mean, that is, you're going to get them in and then start charging them. I'm not sure. And secondly, we have so much choice when it comes to banks in this country. There are a lot of current account choices out there. We can be quite fluid when it comes to banks. We can, as I say, the current account switching service, which I've used in the past, is a really good concept and it's a really good idea. Millions of people have used it to switch a current account. So if you're unhappy with your bank for whatever reason, maybe it's you're unhappy with this kind of noise about potentially a monthly fee on your current account, or perhaps you want to switch to one that has a glossy app or it has better overdraft rates. You know, you can use this current account switching service and it's pretty easy.
Before I get Simon's views on this, just one final thing. I myself am exactly the person you described, Lee. I went to university, HSBC on White Ladies Road, and I'm still with HSBC on White Ladies Road, even though I haven't been to White Ladies Road in many years. Bristol, by the way. The issue is, Lee, why a lot of people probably don't switch is because they don't know what else is out there. I mean, I've never experienced another banking lover, so I don't know whether there's one that's better out there. It seems to be fine. However, there's going to be a lot of people like me that are going to hear noises like this and think, maybe I should be moving or switching about. But then when you say it's much of a muchness, if one follows, they're all going to follow suit. So should I bother? Basically, what I'm asking you is, what should someone in my position do?
Well, I think, Georgie, at the end of the day, you've been with HSBC for all of that time for a reason. And the reason why you're probably still with them is that it's done what it says on the tin for you. You know, you've had your money safely in the current account.
As well, though. It's fine. Yeah, it's fine.
You know, you've never had a run-in with them where you've been cross with HSBC and it's made you move your feet. And that's what a lot of people feel like. You know, and actually, I think a lot of people were worried about that kind of current account upheaval, you know, subscriptions, direct debits, your wages, all of that kind of thing, your mortgage payments, your rent payments, all that sort of thing. You think, oh, is it all worth it just for marginal gains? And I think that's what a lot of people do feel like with their current account. It feels like there's a lot of admin in there. On that flip side, all of that admin comes at a cost, doesn't it, to the banks? And that's the thing I'm trying to say here, is that running a current account isn't cheap for banks. They're like almost like a loss leader for other products. But Georgie, look, at the end of the day, if you're happy at HSBC, if you're happy with your bank and you have no reason to move, why move? You know, unless you want to bag some incentive cash elsewhere, they all largely do the same thing. So this is the point I'm trying to make. And as I say, with all the choice that we have on offer, even with negative interest rates, and this is all big ifs and buts and coulds, you know, I'd be surprised if there wouldn't ever be an account that you could run that didn't come with a monthly fee. And we've just become so accustomed to it in this country. That's the long and short of it.
Simon, I want to get your views on this. I want to get your views firstly on things like negative interest rates. Lee alluded to there that there has been quite a lot of talk about it. Just explain to us briefly what that would entail exactly.
Negative interest rates. Yeah, I'm all over those. I think we should go -5, -5, get people spending. Come on, borrow some money, people, spend some money. We're in a recession. No, I don't think it's going to happen. And I don't think it's a particularly good idea. And actually, it's less about individuals like you, me, or even Mr. Boyce with his millions of pounds, who would be very affected by a -5% interest rate. It's about the banks themselves. And effectively, what it means is that the banks get charged for holding money with the Bank of England, thus encouraging them to lend out that money and do something more useful with the money rather than just sitting on piles of cash. Because what you have in times of financial crisis, recession, and this one isn't called the financial crisis, but I think we can probably say that this is not only a global pandemic, but also a financial crisis, is that banks get a bit more hoardy rather than lendy. And it means that they don't really want to hand out their cash. Look at the complete collapse in 10% deposit mortgages, 15% deposit mortgages even, you know, as house prices are going up. We got news this morning that house prices are up 5.8% over the past year. Ordinarily, in that scenario, banks would be tumbling over themselves to lend money, whereas that was what they were doing in January and even February. Since then, they've shut the doors. Business lending, I mean, the difficulty is do businesses really want to borrow at the moment, other than kind of emergency loans? So, but ideally, you want more business lending rather than property lending. But negative interest rates, you know, the idea is the bank gets charged for holding money at the Bank of England, so the bank is more likely to lend that money out. In order to get people to borrow it, there's increased supply of money, so they lower the rates, which encourages more people to borrow, and it gets the economy moving. And it becomes a way of trying to stave off potential deflation or keep money in the economy, so keep the money supply up. We talked about negative interest rates on the podcast the other week, and I don't envisage a scenario very similar to what Lee said, where you wouldn't find a bank as a consumer, ignoring the Bank of England and the banks bit, as a consumer, I don't envisage a scenario where you wouldn't find a bank that was willing to give you at least a small return on your money, or at least not charge you. So it was at least zero on your savings account. I'd expect you'd still be getting Best Buy rates on easy access of 0.5% or something like that. Now, 0.5% is pretty lousy, but if other people are charging you 0.5% or giving you -0.5%, then you're going to go to them. So the only, you know, unless you actually banned positive savings rates, you're always going to be able to get a savings rate. Unless you actually banned people offering free current accounts, I think you're always going to be able to get a free current account because there'll always be someone in there. And listening to what you guys were saying made me think a couple of things. One, where did it come from? Well, Lee was told by Mark Mullins, Midland Bank. So it's a marketing ploy, wasn't it? Two, who are they going to charge? Probably not the rich people, probably the poor people. So there's going to have to be some rules brought in to make sure that poorer people still have access to banking because it's going to cause them problems if they don't. They can't get paid, etc. So that's going to limit the amount of charging. Three, they're probably going to be some kind of limited time only offers. It's going to be like a signing up to a subscription, a couple of months free, 3 months free, and then you pay X amount and so on. And four, one of the reasons why this has caught on so well and so much is because your current account is the best way of your bank marketing to you. So the marketing value of having you as a customer is quite high, and it's worth the bank absorbing the cost of a current account every year, owing to the fact that it has your details, it knows what you're doing, what you spend your money on, and it can market stuff to you. And so I think that there's always going to be a bank out there that decides it's worth A, getting people in by offering them free banking, and B, getting the data on that back end. And the other problem with the banks, though, is that, yeah, running a current account costs money, but what they're also missing is the fact that they used to make an awful lot of money off a number of rackets that they had, where they were effectively ripping people off. Unauthorized overdraft charges, the thing that blew this whole thing open. You know, at one point, they were a charge for people going over their overdraft. Now, arguably, you shouldn't be able to go over your overdraft. You should go to the end of your overdraft and then you should stop. But banks were allowing people to do this because they were profiteering on people who were doing it. And unfortunately, you know, after case and appeal and case and appeal and case and appeal, the banks won the unauthorized overdraft charges thing in the end, and people shouldn't have been borrowing money. They shouldn't be borrowing, and they were paying through the nose for it. But banks were massively profiteering on it. And the other big stream of income that they've obviously lost is PPI, which, again, just a massive racket. A racket that the banks were alerted to years before they actually stopped mis-selling PPI. They continued to mis-sell PPI for years and years after they had been told by numerous places, including This Is Money, other rival publications, etc. This is a ripoff. So what they're doing is they're looking at how profitable it used to be to run their current account operations and going, well, it's not that profitable anymore. How are we going to make it that profitable? How do we get that money back? And maybe some of those profits were oversized profits that they should just give up. It's difficult telling a bank shareholder that. Actually, a bank shareholder gets it, because a bank shareholder doesn't want another PPI bill that runs for years and years and years. It's difficult telling the executives who work for the banks and get paid on performance and get massive bonuses that. And those very same executives who presided over bank charges, profiteering, and PPI are still the same people running banks in this country. And I think that's the reckoning of PPI that should have come, is those people should have been drummed out of the banking industry for the amount of money that they cost people and rampant mis-selling.
Agreed. Just one final point, though, on this before we wrap it up. Is there something to be said about, and I'm not saying that we should have current accounts which charge, but there's something to be said about having the transparency of banks are not going to be clawing back money elsewhere, doing other dodgy practices. This is your current account. This is how much it costs us to run it. And this is how much you're going to be charged. You're not going to be marketed at or have any dodgy little things going on in the background. This is it. This is what we're going to charge you.
Maybe. I mean,
it's not going to happen. I mean, you know, that. They're still going to market you.
It's more fun to not take that reasonable position and go on a rant about bank bosses and PPI and bank charges, to be honest. But as an assessment of that question, yes, I suppose that's reasonable. But then there's lots of other places in life where the costs are absorbed, aren't there? I mean, should we ban free delivery on internet shopping? Because some places charge you and some don't. But the places that don't charge you, they're absorbing the costs elsewhere. A business can choose to absorb the costs, or it can choose to charge people. Well, I don't know. Yeah, there is. But I tell you what, maybe there's a bank account out there for someone can charge for it. And they can say, look, it's going to cost you £4 a month. We promise it's like an ad free experience. We promise never to try and flog you anything else. We'll never sell your anonymized data. We'll never do this. We'll never do that. You know, and that they could just make a list of promises of things that they kind of won't do. Yeah.
All right, well, we'll move on from this. We're going to stick to things coming to an end, though, although we've said that free banking is probably not going to come to an end, but then neither is sort of furlough, I guess, because after many, many months, 10 million workers, £40 billion bill, furlough comes to an end on the 31st of October. Halloween. I mean, the headlines write themselves, don't they? Because it's not just furlough changing to the less generous job support scheme, which is what we're going to get in its place, but a number of other measures that have been brought in during this time to help us out financially come to an end on the very same day. Now, millions have taken out mortgage payment holidays, breaks from loans, credit cards, insurance. They've taken advantage of free overdrafts, pauses in repossessions. Now, regulators reckon that as many as 12 million could struggle to pay their bills once these have been taken away. So Lee, just give us a rundown. What is changing? Obviously, furlough is perhaps the most famous one. We've spoken about that. We're going to get the job support scheme, but there are plenty of other measures that are going to be gone.
That's right, George. Yes. I mean, this weekend, it does feel like a bit of a Halloween horror show, doesn't it, for people's personal finances, depending on how they've been affected during coronavirus and what it's done for their own personal finances. So furlough, as you say, is coming to an end and it's been replaced by the job support scheme. It's paid out £35 billion furlough since March, which gives you an indication of how much it's helped prop up people's wages. And this new winter plan is almost like a light version of furlough, I would argue. And it means people potentially aren't going to be getting as much wages as they've been used to during this crisis. Could also see a number of jobs lost, and we've already seen quite a jobs bloodbath anyway. And the whole idea of this is to stop it all just dropping off a cliff and trying to keep things ticking over a little bit. But for some, they're going to fall into that kind of trap where it's going to be difficult to keep going day to day, because not only is that ending, it's all of the other support packages that we've had from banks, for example. So things like, as you mentioned, mortgage payment holidays. Now, I hate calling it a mortgage payment holiday because it's not really a holiday. You know, you're going to end up paying more interest on that later down the line. But for many people, you know, mortgage is probably their biggest outgoing. If they're unable to pause that any further, you know, there could be all sorts of horrible stories coming out about people losing their homes and all of that kind of thing. Now, the government is quite keen, I believe, for that type of scenario not to happen. So if you are in that boat, if you are worried about how you're going to pay your mortgage, perhaps you've lost your job, you must get in touch with your bank and not just bury your head in the sand, because that's when you're going to get into all sorts of problems. Actually, the mortgage payment holidays as well, I mean, it is something that existed anyway. I mean, if you lost your job, sometimes a bank would let you have a 3 months payment holiday. You know, it's almost like a last resort to give you some breathing space. So we've got, when I'm saying it's coming to an end, I mean, if you've used that 3 months up, it might be difficult to do it again. And there's all this whole argument about it going on your credit rating and all that kind of thing, which, you know, isn't great. But 2.5 million people have taken advantage of that, Georgie. 2.5 million people.
That's just the mortgage, yeah.
That's just a mortgage. That's just a mortgage.
You've got credit cards, loans.
Yeah, so then we go on to the other bits and pieces. So, you know, car finance is another big one. You know, people are used to in this country putting a down payment on, having a car for 3 years and making, you know, quite chunky payments. I would argue that probably that's going to be the second biggest outgoing for most people. Potentially might not be, but for many it will be. Those kind of things are coming to an end, as well as you say, overdrafts. Banks have handed out 27,500 pound interest-free overdrafts during the crisis. That is an incredible number.
Weren't some of them doing it automatically though? So some had to apply and some were automatic.
Exactly.
Yeah, and people may not have used their just.
And again, people shouldn't be left out of pocket. So if you're someone that's like kind of deep into this overdraft, and you realise you're going to be in this situation, again, it's all about contacting your bank and seeing what kind of repayment plans you can potentially manage to muster up. There's all sorts of help and advice out there. We've got a piece of some details here actually in this story about this, because it's a worry for people, Georgie. This is, you know, this is like we pressed the pause button and now we're pressing the play button again, and people's scenarios, situations haven't changed. Yeah. And there's that worry about how people have coped in the last 6 months, whether it be sticking things on credit cards, perhaps using some personal loan, or, you know, the money that they're saving, not paying their mortgage and all of that kind of thing. So I would encourage to get in touch with whoever your lender is, whoever your bank is. Sit down this weekend, figure out what you're going to be getting in income-wise. Figure out where your expenditure might be coming back out again. If you're going to really struggle, get in touch with them. But also charities like Step Change. So as I said, we've got these details in here. And it's launched a payment plan to help hard-up households out of debt. It's called the COVID Payment Plan. It's been developed with the Treasury. So you can visit its website, which is stepchange.org, or you can phone it on 0800 138 quadruple one. Give those guys a call, and just don't, please, if you're listening to this and you're in that situation, or you know someone that's going to be in that situation, this is not a time for being proud. It's not a time for sticking your head in the sand.
Exactly.
It is time to really think about. And there's going to be, I'd like to think, a whole raft of measures still out there, so people just don't find their personal finances fall off a cliff. You know, it's better to get a hold on this as early as possible, I would argue.
Absolutely. It should be that your lender contacts you, but I wouldn't wait for that. If you need support and you need help, then do, as Lee said, get in contact, and contact charities as well if you need to. Just talk about it. But yes, burying your head in the sand is not going to change it. I should also point out, or we should be very clear, that if you have taken out a payment holiday and you're in the middle of it, it doesn't stop on the 31st. It's applications for new ones will stop on the 31st. But as Lee pointed out, you can still get some sort of help. The FCA have spoken to the banks and said they need to offer support and help and guidance for their customers during this time. So it might be that you offered something a little bit more tailored for you. But as Lee pointed out before, it wasn't going to affect your credit rating. Now it may do, but if it does, the bank should let you know that that is the case. We did have some scary figures that came out, Simon. I think it was the BBC that produced these figures, saying the number of companies that notified the government of plans to cut 20 or more posts in September. Of course, you have to have consultation periods of 30 and 45 days. It was 1,734 employers. So over the next couple of weeks, we'll probably get a lot more figures about redundancies that will be taking place. It does seem to be, as Lee pointed out there, that while we are ramping up and thoughts about perhaps another lockdown, as we're seeing in other countries, as ramping up some of the restrictions, the support measures are, well, nowhere near what they were when this first came out.
No, they're not. The support measures were designed to deal with a short-term emergency crisis that the thinking was going to be done in a few months back then. If you cast your minds back to the heady days of late March and early April, the idea was that we'd be through it by summer. That's obviously not the case, and things are starting to tighten up again. I guess that the defence against that from the government is that they threw a lot of money at the problem, gave out a lot of support, but that money can't just keep coming endlessly. And also that the economy is more open now than it was then. Everything was shut apart from essential shops in terms of like retail and stuff. All the restaurants were shut, all the bars were shut, all the pubs were shut. I mean, what you had, the supermarkets and the DIY stores and B&M, which had managed to work its way around it, but had closed off things like the toy aisle. I mean, once you're in the shop, you might as well let someone buy a toy.
Even get me started.
You know, the kids aren't allowed to go. The kids weren't allowed to go to school. They weren't allowed to go. They had nothing they were allowed to do. But you can't sell them toys. But you could order them on Amazon. So at least Jeff Bezos was making a bit more dough. If you think back to then, everything was a lot more shut than it is now. Plus, there was a big question mark hanging over how much stuff could keep going with the whole people working from home thing. Now, there's lots of people who can't work from home, and a lot of those workplaces just shut as well, or they have bare bones staff in. Now, you know, even if they do ramp up the lockdown further, which it seems unfortunately that inevitably that's going to happen at some point, you're going to find more businesses who can't have staff work from home, who are able to accommodate many more staff than they could in April, COVID secure, all that kind of stuff. And in terms of the work from home thing, most of the businesses that sent their staff home to work from home have realized that actually their staff could work pretty much fine from home, and that it wasn't anywhere near as disruptive as people feared. And I think if you look at the mood music from the government, they're doing everything they possibly can to try and keep some of those businesses open that were previously told to shut. So I suppose that would be their defense, but it does feel like we're going into a potentially long, bleak autumn and winter whilst dialing down all the help that people are getting at a time when they probably need it more. But
But as Lee said, well, let's hope there is support available for those people coming on the horizon. Now, Simon, we're swimming in debt, borrowing money hand over fist. Brexit looms. The US election looms even closer. Second wave fears abound. Bitcoin is back. Shake it all together. What do we have here, Simon? What do we have?
Oh, the people who backed Bitcoin, they were just right all along. It wasn't a fad. It wasn't a swizz. You know, get back to those days of like sitting on the bus or in the canteen and overhearing someone saying that they'd lumped a load of money in and they'd bought Bitcoin and Litecoin and Dogecoin and this coin and that coin and Coincoin. Yeah. You know, Bitcoin's back on the up. Bitcoin's been, I don't know if you can describe something that's gone up by quite as much as it has done over the past year as having a bit of a slow burn, but it has been having a bit of a slow burn out of the limelight compared to the days of Bitcoin mania, which I want to say was nearly 3 years ago. Is that right? Christmas 2017.
We're all nodding here, which doesn't help for the podcast, yeah. But I thought it was
okay. Yeah, yeah. Lee's agreeing with me here. Yeah. And it went bananas. And I mean, you know, people who bought in before that would still have been sitting on a nice chunk of profit on their Bitcoin. But people who bought in sort of around that time would have made a loss until recently. Some of them still will be sitting on a loss if they bought right at the top. And people who bought in just after, on the dip, just after, thinking, ooh, this is a chance to get in before it then did a little rise back up and then sunk again, will also have been sitting on a loss. And some will have just been sitting about even. I've got about £1,000 in an eToro account on Bitcoin that I bought at one point. I bought it as an insurance policy against my friend being right, because he put a load of money into Bitcoin, and I was like, well, I mean, he's totally wrong, he's gonna lose his money, but if it does go to $100,000, maybe I'll just buy a bit. So, you know, he did say to me, have you bought an insurance policy against me doing well? I was like, yeah, but I'm up $453 on it. Nice. and it's been knocking around. Until relatively recently, it's been knocking around the kind of level with what I paid for it for a long time. And every time I'd look at it and it was up by a bit, and I'd mention it, we'd have a conversation in the office, me and Mr. Boyce, the Bitcoin price would promptly slump. So I would like to apologize to anyone who's invested in Bitcoin at the moment, because I've just said that on the podcast, and Bitcoin will probably half in price as of today. People are trading it. People are chasing the gains up. You know, just as at the moment they're chasing things down in the stock market, they're selling out the stock market. The stock market has had a major wobble this week and actually over the last few weeks, driven by a couple of things. One, concern over fresh lockdowns and coronavirus restrictions. I mean, they've been ramped up heavily in Europe, they're getting ramped up here. There's concerns about how much they'll get ramped up in the States. Then there's the US election. We talked about this on the podcast the other week. I'm not sure the market and investors, you know, the market as a collection of investors and traders really knows what it wants from the US election. I'm not sure whether it actually cares whether it's Trump or Biden. I think it just wants the money to keep flowing. The money has been paused by the US election, and there's a little bit of worry that maybe the money won't be forthcoming after the US election. But the bigger worry is that the US election will be too close to call and it will lead to some kind of chaos and you know, no side conceding and so on and so on. So that's causing that bit of a wobble. But yeah, in the meantime, Bitcoin's on the rise. But Bitcoin is largely detached from, I want to say reality, but it's not. The thing about all these coins that came up is there was a jokingly, I was listing this coin, that coin, all that kind of stuff. There was a lot of them and there was a big boom in the coin issuance, and some of them were just a scam. One of them said it was a scam, wasn't it? A load of people put money into it. Actually had a web page that basically said this is a Ponzi scheme and people put money into it. Wow. I mean, there was a complete mania. It was like watching the tulip bubble at the time. I remember us saying it was astonishing. But a lot of those have obviously fallen by the wayside. Some of the other ones that weren't as high profile as Bitcoin have done okay, but not sort of taken over the world in the way that everyone thought they'd overtake Bitcoin. And Bitcoin, I guess, has started to prove itself as a store of value. It's a highly erratic store of value, but it is a store of value. It's detached from the world of governments and their spending and their fiat currency, and it's decentralized.
Is that it though, Simon? Why it's so appealing, maybe?
Bitcoin's best chance of success is carving itself out as a rival to gold. Long term. I've always thought that the best chance of Bitcoin proving to be a long term store of value would be A, it's the one everybody knows about, right? And that helps. Okay. B, it's in highly limited supply. You can't really make that much more of it. And C, if it can do a kind of even a gold light kind of thing, then it becomes something that's potentially worth having. But you know, you're not going to know the answer to that for 2,000 years.
Okay, well, fair enough. All right. So we won't know the answer. Lee, what do you reckon?
I'm just going to throw just a quick bit of context into this, Georgie. So when we're talking about January 2018 and that Bitcoin run, it went up to $20,000 a coin. It was absolutely incredible. It just risen within a month so quickly. It dropped as low as $3,000 and it's just been sort of ticking along, you know, ever since then. But the last few weeks, it's gone as high as $14,000 a coin. Now, that is the highest level it's been since that January run. When it just went absolutely crazy. There's a couple of things that have pushed the price higher of Bitcoin. One of the big things was an announcement by PayPal saying that from next year, US customers will be able to buy, hold, and sell Bitcoin with PayPal. Now, PayPal is a massive global company. It's a very familiar name for most. That makes it more mainstream. It gives it a little bit more, you know, impetus, and people are kind of, okay, now PayPal are getting involved. Maybe this gives it a little bit more credibility. That alone saw almost $1,000 added to the value in a day just from that announcement. The other big thing that happened was that Jack Dorsey, who's the founder of Twitter, announced that he had $50 million worth of Bitcoin, which is through his payments company, which is called Square. Again, that added a little bit more of credibility to Bitcoin. So the price has been kind of nudging a little bit higher. And, you know, people are just trying to get involved. They're just speculating. They're just trying to get buy up on that high. As we had this FCA report that I'd written about a few months ago, which basically shows that almost half of people who have bought Bitcoin in Britain have never done anything with it. They've just bought it literally just to hope that it goes up in value. And the average person had about 260 quid in it. Now, last week, I bought Bitcoin for the first time. Now, the reason why I bought Bitcoin was actually for some research purposes, which I won't go into. But I wanted to see how complicated it was to buy Bitcoin. And in that FCA report I just mentioned, the majority of people had bought it through a website called Coinbase. So I wanted to see how easy it was to use Coinbase, because there is that worry. When that first bubble of Bitcoin came up, I just didn't want to get involved whatsoever, because it was such a new kind of cryptocurrency. Was such a new, it wasn't new, but it was kind of still in that kind of stage where there wasn't any websites that would say was trustworthy enough. Worried about what they're doing with your data. Worry about, you know, storing card details somewhere, for example. Worries about if that money's just going to vanish. So I've given Coinbase a chance. It was relatively easy, quite straightforward, to be honest with you. You do have to send ID. So I had to send a photograph of my driving license, which, as you know, as someone that's written about scams a lot over the years, made me a little bit nervous. But for the research purposes, I decided to go on with it. And then I actually tried to transfer money from one of my bank accounts into Coinbase. So it doesn't hold card details. It's just your bank account number and your sort code. And the bank blocked it, said it didn't accept crypto exchanges. You couldn't make a payment to a crypto exchange. So that was my secondary current account. I won't reveal who that was. So I had to use my main current account and stick the money over. And that was fine. It worked. So I now own Bitcoin. A week later, well, here we go. There's been a run on Bitcoin. What can I say? I mean, but that's not an encouragement for people to get involved. I honestly bought it for research purposes. But that's just to give a bit of context, you know, what's happening in Bitcoin and how it's become this second wave around easier, I would argue, to get involved and store this stuff. As Simon said, he uses eToro, Coinbase. You know, just if you are going to get involved, massive, massive warnings, you know, your money's not protected. FCA have come out with all kinds of rules about derivatives and things like that. So you want to make sure that you've done your homework, it's going somewhere safe, and just start with a very small amount if you are tempted. And this is not an endorsement of cryptocurrencies or Bitcoin whatsoever.
Simon?
You just reminded me of what happened when I bought that Bitcoin. I'd forgotten about this. So basically, I remember having this conversation about Bitcoin and about the chart and about sort of charting and points of resistance and at what point it would bounce. And my argument was that after the initial Bitcoin mania that caught a lot of people out, actually, a lot of traders were like, what? Huh? How is this happening? This is completely crazy. It was just going up straight in the air at one point. When it then fell heavily and then the price started moving, more traders started trading the price. And if you use basic sort of technical analysis and charting with, lines of resistance and support and things like that, they don't have any predictive powers. They just map fundamentally human behavior, greed, mm-hmm. panic, fear, all that kind of stuff. And so you see the same things repeat themselves. And I remember saying it's going to bounce at this point here. That's probably what will happen, or it'll go straight through it and keep falling. So, you know, it's like one of those things where you say, well, it's definitely going to be a boy, unless it's a girl. And it did bounce. And I went to try and buy some. And I tried to buy some through Coinbase because I couldn't, because I needed ID and didn't have my passport, and I couldn't get my passport to scan. And then my driving license, because I've got an old fashioned driving license, that wouldn't work either. And I remember saying at the time, so much for newfangled anonymized digital currency, I can't buy it because basically I don't have my passport and I can't get my passport to scan. I was like, that's not anonymized digital currency. That's my passport. So then I opened an eToro account instead and bought it through eToro. But in the time it took me to do all of this, the price of Bitcoin moved up by about $1,000, I seem to remember. So I would have got in lower. I had completely forgotten about this, that this has actually happened. So yeah, there you go. Look, you can do all you want with your newfangled cryptocurrencies and all that, but you'll still get caught out by the old-fashioned stuff of the bank, etc., or them just needing to verify you with a scan of your passport.
Indeed.
It's got to be a better way of verifying people than with scans.
Don't go down there.
I'm sure there was some kind of cryptocurrency that was going to solve that problem.
One day in the future. But we're going to stick with old-fashioned, actually, for the final piece, away from the, I don't know, gloom and doom. I don't think it's been gloom and doom talking about Bitcoin, certainly not with you two. But a sort of good news story until it's not a good news story, if that makes sense. Someone who's had a boiler. It's going great guns for 28 years. This is great. We don't want to throw stuff away, except it's probably been throwing out loads of dirtiness, but either way. However, the not so good news comes because the company that has been servicing this, I should point out, this is a reader question. I'm just not talking about a random boiler that's doing really well. This is a question from one of your readers. So it's going great guns, doing very well. However, the company that serviced it every year since 1992, I hope they give them a Christmas card every year. It's that sort of story, isn't it? But now they say it's just far too ancient to presumably bother. And there might be some legal issues. I don't know, Lee, you'll tell me. And actually, this family, your reader, needs a new boiler. And they want to know, look, do I really need to replace my working boiler? Or is this person just trying to get more money out of me to install a costly new one? And the answer, Lee, is...
Georgie, this is money. Working here is always a learning curve. It's always an experience. It's something that I always pick up at least once a week, something new, something that I learn. This week, it was all about boilers, and I really, really, really like this story. So someone's written in, they've got a Potterton boiler. Now, the reason why I say it's a Potterton boiler is because in our reader comments, people are singing the praises of Potterton boilers and how good they are and how long they've lasted, right? Which firstly, I love that kind of detail, right? So they've had this boiler for 28 years. The other thing I found really interesting about this person has had this boiler serviced every year. Goes to show you that having a boiler service regularly probably will keep it in good shape. Now, a boiler service is massively important, but going into a massive rabbit hole, you know, they clean it out, they do all the bits and pieces, take parts out that need cleaning up and looking at and all that kind of stuff. When I first read this question that came in and I was editing this story, straight away I thought, this guy's trying it on. You know, he wants to charge you to fit a new boiler. You know, it can be relatively expensive. And he's just not servicing it because of that reason. I then had a look at what kind of our experts were saying in this and the people that we spoke to. And I changed my mind. I realized that some of these parts and whatnot are hard to replace now. You know, these spare parts start to disappear and they're not as easy to get hold of anymore. And also the bill that this person has been charged, their annual gas bill for a four-bedroom house is £1,300, which is an expensive gas bill. And it makes you wonder whether the boiler isn't as efficient as it could be, which could mean if you got a new boiler and that gas bill came down by, you know, a few hundred quid, probably more than that, because of a new efficient boiler, it would pay for itself after that time. And sometimes we form an emotional attachment, even if it's a boiler. Do you form an emotional attachment with a boiler? You would probably say no, but there are people out there that have had them for a very long time. I know a relative that has a boiler that we reckon it's somewhere between 35 and 40 years old. That boiler is still going. You go around that person's house and it is like stepping into an exotic time zone. It is a boiler that has worked, and you look at it and you think, wow, this boiler is something from ancient history, you know. But yeah, you know, these things last. How efficient that boiler is, though, is the real crux. And of course, the most important thing is how safe it is. You know, you want to make sure that it's at the top of safety standards and all that kind of thing. Now, the person in question, the person that's written in, you know, I would have thought the plumber would tell her or tell this person that it's not safe. Do you know what I mean? No, if there was some sort of issue around it, you know, especially with gas, you would just say this is unsafe and it needs replacing. It's not saying that. It's just saying that it's becoming more and more difficult to get replacement parts and to think about replacing it. And actually, we had someone from Energy Helpline saying that bill was incredible, that a typical gas bill for a home is 455 quid. But it's quite a big difference. Yeah. You know, okay, a slightly bigger house than the average, but it shouldn't be anywhere near that. And you do have to question whether it is the fault of the boiler. But anyway, I think, you know, potentially, you know, I know I'm joking around. You say you form an emotional attachment with a boiler. I think people do, Georgie. It's kept you warm for decades upon decades. And it's that fear of change, like changing a bank account, like changing the current account. You don't want to like swap around what you know. You know, what if it's not as good? What if you get a boiler that only lasts 10 years and you think, oh, God, I remember having that Potterton boiler that lasted three decades. Now look at this cheap number that they've thrown in here that's just not working properly. Will you form emotional attachments with the more loyal we stay to something, Georgie, whether it's a boiler, whether it's a current account, and you need to know that moment when you need to let go. But hey, if you've got a boiler, if I want to know who out there has got the oldest boiler that's still working, yeah, let us know. Editor at thisismoney.co.uk. At thisismoney.co.uk even.
Sad tale in the end there, Lee. Yep, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team, or you have a really, 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 really old boiler, anything else you'd like them to look into, Simon?
Just to be clear, if you have any old school Bernard Manning style jokes about old boilers to refer to your wife that you've been married to for years and years and years, we don't need those. No, okay, we don't need necessary. To be spammed with those. Yeah, just to knock. Take that one out of the past, basically. Yeah. You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate and read the comments. And the only thing I would say on the boiler replacement thing is if you do get a new boiler after having had one for some time, be aware that new boilers can cause problems with old pipes and they can cause a leak. And I know numerous people, myself included, who had a new boiler put in and get a leak at a join in the pipe. And it was fine for us because we got it in a bathroom, right, where you could see it and you could spot it and it was onto a tiled floor. But you hear about people getting them under the floor and stuff like that. So when you get that plumber around and you speak to them about getting a new boiler, ask them about the pipes and what they're going to do about the pipes, and to make sure that you don't spring a leak that you don't know about, because the leak that you don't know about can cause thousands of pounds worth of damage and a massive headache. And you should be properly insured if you've got any sense. But yeah, be careful. New boilers, old pipes, be careful.
Sage advice there, Simon. Sage advice. If you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.